I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order for Wednesday, March 12th. Thank you, members, for being here. We have a pretty long agenda, but we're going to get started and hopefully do some good work here before 5 or 5:30 this afternoon. Up first on our agenda, we have a confirmation for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and I would ask Mr. Cervantes to please come forward and introduce yourself to the committee and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I'm ready when you are.
Proceed whenever you're ready.
Okay. My name is Manuel Cervantes. I was appointed by the Governor, Mark Dayton, last year at about this time to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. I'm here this afternoon to be confirmed by the Senate committee, or pass it on from your committee to the whole Senate. I'll give you a little bit of background. I'm an attorney, obviously. I began as a young attorney representing federal employees at the American Federation of Government Employees. I represented them in arbitrations and disciplinary actions, but I also represented them in trying to obtain medical benefits from them. I was there for about 5 years, and then in 1986, I was appointed to this very court, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, by then-Governor Rudy Perpich. I ruled on cases that were coming before the court at that time. Just before that, in 1983, the Minnesota legislature comprehensively reformed the workers' compensation statute and created a new document. And it went from 35 pages to about 300 pages. So needless to say, the court was very busy at that time, taking cases from the trial bench, approximately 25 judges that hear only workers' compensation cases. And then the parties are entitled to appeal it to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. And so we heard hundreds and hundreds of cases and gave depth to the new law. And I fulfilled my 6-year term in 92. I was appointed in 1992 to the district court, where I presided there in family court, juvenile court, housing court, and did other matters there. I was there for 10 years in 1982. Then Mayor Randy Kelly asked me to serve as the St. Paul City Attorney. I thought to myself, why would I leave the Ramsey County District Court bench and go on to become city attorney? And my wife reminded me that I was losing sleep over my divorce cases and the difficulty of raising kids because of my obligation to stand in the shoes of children in very difficult custody and visitation issues. And so I said, yeah, I have been, haven't I? So I met with the mayor. I decided to take the job, and I did that for 4 more years at the city of St. Paul. Since then, I was a judge over at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I did that for a handful of years. And then the governor offered me this appointment, and I have graciously taken it. I'm so happy to have a second bite of the apple and to do very important work that the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals does. And I stand for any questions, if you have any.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions for the witness? If not, I'd like to thank you. I think that we're very lucky to have an individual with your vast experience to be able to help on the Work Comp Court of Appeals. So with that, I would look for a motion. Senator Schmidt moves the confirmation of Manuel Cervantes as judge for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals to the Senate floor with a recommendation to confirm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators.
Next on our agenda is Senator Scalzi. Yep. Senator Scalzi has Senate File 2193. The Pollution Control Agency bill, and I think, members, we're going to focus only on Section 12 that has jurisdiction within this committee. So I think that that's where Senator Scalzi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is my bill, Senate File 2193. It's a bill proposed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it includes proposals for permitting efficiencies and duty changes of the agency. In response to the executive order of 2011, the permitting efficiency law, the MNPCA was directed to improve permitting timelines, and we've been working also with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on this bill. And here to present the bill is Kirk Kudelka.
Mr. Kudelka, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. And thank you to Senator Scalzi for carrying the regulatory efficiency bill. We appreciate this. As the senator mentioned, this bill adds on to work been done by the legislature starting in 2010 and then 11 and 12 with permit efficiency. And I'd like to just focus on Section 12 of the bill dealing with Minnesota Business First Stop. Minnesota Business First Stop is led by DEED, but a number of agencies, including the MPCA, DNR, and other agencies are a part of it in an effort to help new businesses establish themselves in Minnesota and expand, but also help them through the regulatory process. And one of the things that we'd like to do here is update that language where there's that case so the agency and others can work where there's that pre-feasibility of a project, where folks are out even before they're turning in an application, they've got an idea in their mind, and they want to work with the agencies to be able to figure out how to make it work in Minnesota and how to make it as efficient as possible. And so that's the change we would like to make in this bill. It adds to our expedited services that's provided by the agency and the DNR has in this bill, and it would be create a fee-for-service ability.
Thank you. Any questions from members on Mr. Senator Dames?
Mr. Chair and Mr.
Chair, excuse me. Mr. Kudelka, line 1720 through 1725, section 12, page 17. Talking about reimbursement for the project proposal shall proceed, not be contingent upon the issuance of a permit. How is that being handled now?
Mr. Kudelka, oops. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. That mirrors some other language, too. It just ensures that when someone goes into this process, they don't come with the understanding that they're guaranteed a permit. The project, a permit, or an environmental review is decision is based on its merit.
Senator Dames.
Currently, are we requiring the reimbursement by the project proposer? At this point, are we requiring that?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, to this point, the PCA has not required any reimbursements. Where we see a potential reimbursement is if we get a number of companies in a large batch that overdoes what our services can provide at that point, there would be that option. But to date, the PCA has not charged anyone using Business First Stop.
Senator Dames.
So this is another option for to collect fees then that we don't currently have that option for?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. And it is at the choice of the individuals if they would like to use the ability.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Any other questions from members? If not, I would entertain a motion. Senator Schmidt then moves that Senate File 2193 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair and members, very much.
You want to go next, man? Senator Tomasoni in the room? If not, maybe we'll move down. Senator Schmidt, you ready to go with your bill?
I'm ready.
Okay. Senator Schmidt has Senate File 2065. Senator Schmidt, welcome to the committee.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair and committee members. We have some familiar faces around the table here. It's good to be with you here. I have before us Senate File 2065, and what we're intending to do is make a program that deals with misclassification of construction workers in industry, not only a pilot program but a permanent fixture in Department of Labor and Industry. And there's a number of related policy changes along with the transition from a pilot program to a permanent policy here. And I do have some good testimony lined up here today, and I would just as soon get into that testimony as quick as we can. Definitely yield for any questions that members may have along the way.
Perfect.
Sir,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm an assistant director in the Construction Codes and Licensing Division at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm very happy to be here today before you to talk about Senator Schmidt's bill that would take the contractor registration pilot program that the legislature enacted in 2012 to make permanent. Just briefly, the history of this program, our whole effort in state government between the Department of Labor and Industry, DEED, and the Department of Revenue to work on enforcement and regulation of worker misclassification was a result of a legislative auditor's report in 2007 that identified this issue as an important problem in the construction industry in the state. In 2009, we enacted an independent contractor exemption certificate program in an effort to try to determine individuals' ability to act as an independent contractor. And the issue here really is protecting the rights of workers who are actually employees and should be treated as employees and enjoy the benefits of being an employee, but their employers are treating them as independent contractors for different reasons to avoid certain obligations. And so the Independent Contractor Exemption Certificate Program intended to help us identify true independent contractors as opposed to those who are being treated as independent contractors but cannot possibly be an independent contractor because they don't meet the 9-factor test that's been in statute for quite some time. That program was not successful primarily because it applied only to individual proprietors, which then caused a number of these individuals to form corporations and LLCs, which created a larger problem for us, quite frankly, as regulators, because the Secretary of State's office does not require disclosure of the identities of the owners of a limited liability company or a corporation. So one of the things that we identified early on in the investigations that our unit did in the area of worker classification was trying to track the flow of money through the different layers of independent contractors down to the individual workers who were receiving the payments to identify whether these people were being properly classified. And quite frankly, the trail ran cold when we would find evidence of payments being made to corporations and LLCs that we couldn't track because there was no ownership information provided at the Secretary of State's office, and oftentimes the addresses that were provided in those filings were bogus as well. So there was a task force that we convened. We brought together members of the construction industry, not only the commercial construction industry, but the residential as well, and other interested parties to try to figure out what's a better way for the state and the industry to address this problem of workers being misclassified. And one of the recommendations of that task force was essentially what became the registration pilot program. And it was a pilot program primarily because we wanted to, first of all, identify who all of the owners of these companies are that are operating as LLCs and corporations after 2009. And also to find out if this is even effective. I mean, if it's not going to be an effective tool to help us in enforcement in this area, there really wasn't much of a point in pursuing it. And the experience that we've had with this program has been very positive. We've been very successful in identifying workers that have been misclassified as a result of identifying the people that employ them. And we've been able to part of it actually is an educational process as well, to educate contractors who may not have known exactly how to classify their workers properly. So there's an educational component to what we've been doing in this program as well as an enforcement component. So we found that it's been very effective. We think that it's very helpful for contractors to have a very easy-to-find place to establish that the contractors that they're hiring are legitimate. The state knows who they are. They can find out who they are. It really enhances, I think, the professionalism of the construction industry, the residential as well as the commercial construction industry. And as an agency, we've had many discussions with our stakeholders in the industries, commercial and residential, and found very broad support for making this program permanent. There was one issue that was brought to our attention that we wanted to address, and Senator Schmidt's legislation does this, and that is the idea that there's a presumption in the law currently that if you're not a registered contractor, you are an employee of any contractor that hires you. And we had our own concerns as well and agreed with the idea that we should change that presumption to a rebuttable presumption that allows a hiring contractor to prove that one of their independent contractors was not actually an employee, even though they weren't registered, if they can demonstrate that that worker met the nine-factor test in the relationship between the hiring contractor and the worker. So that's a key change to the current legislation that's in the bill to create this rebuttable presumption so that a contractor can still have legitimate independent contractors be deemed independent contractors despite the fact that the independent contractor may not have been registered at the time that we found them. Quite frankly, I can quickly walk through the bill. Most of the rest of the changes that are proposed are fairly technical. One thing that we want to do is take some of the language regarding the nuts and bolts of the registration program and move them into Chapter 326B, which is where we have all of our construction contractor licensing statutes, so to make it more aligned with how we regulate and license other actors in the construction industry. We want to extend all the existing registrations that currently expire on June 30th of this year, automatically extend those out one more year, and then begin a two-year registration renewal cycle, similar to how we license other actors in the construction industry on two-year licensing cycles. We want to maintain the idea that this is a very simple process. It's all done online. It's free. It's no cost to the contractor to go online to register. There's no cost to the hiring contractor to go online and use our online license lookup function to verify that their contractors are properly registered. So there's some renumbering that's involved in that. But other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of the members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Durenberger. Any questions for the witness at this time? Not. Thank you. Senator Schmidt, do you have another?
I do understand that we have a testifier. We do have a testifier from Workforce Relations of the Builders and Contractors of Minnesota.
Okay. Ms. Hendrickson, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Martha Hendrickson. I'm with the Associated General Contractors. We have about 200 general and specialty contractor members and in the construction industry. I can keep my comments very brief. The program is fine. We like it. The sense of my organization and our members is that it accomplishes what it set out to do. It's not burdensome in terms of compliance. It's not costly. We support the idea of making it permanent.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the witness, members? If not, Senator Schmidt, do you have anything else you'd like to add at this time?
You know, Mr. Chair and members, I guess I would defer to the wisdom of the committee in terms of next steps, sir. I'm not sure if there's any additional testimony here in the room.
I think we do have a few more people. I just didn't know if you had something else that you wanted to add at this time.
I think we've presented the bill here, and we'd be happy to hear from some other perspectives today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your testimony. Maybe stick around, too, because members might have some more questions after we hear from Remy Stone. I have on the list next with the Builders Association of Minnesota.
See you again.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Remy Stone. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with the committee about the subcontractor registration pilot project. It, as everybody's talked about, was a compromised piece of legislation that happened a couple years ago that addressed some of the issues of misclassification in the construction industry. In our industry, my members, 3,000 strong residential contractors and remodelers and associate members, agreed to go forward with this pilot project with the understanding that it would serve as a platform for us to understand what's going on with misclassification and get a better handle on how we, as an industry overall, construction addresses things like employment, employees versus independent contractors. All very good, solid reasons to move forward with a pilot project. So over the course of the last 2 years, we've had experience with a pilot project that has in some ways been an opportunity for agencies outside of DALI to use as an enforcement against the industry. Intellectually, we have a problem with the idea that a pilot project has been used by agencies that have not been delegated authority to enforce their own rules and laws. We also have an issue with the fact that you're asking very small businesses, residential contractors and remodelers, to do the work of government. We already feel that there are many, many laws on the books that ought to be enforced and ought to be enforced by the agency that's imposing them. But it's not our role as private business to be in the business of doing government's work. Now, mind you, that makes some sense if we're doing public projects. There's a lot of tales that go with the public dollar that goes into a construction project. The majority, vast majority of my members do private work. And the idea that what government is asking out of private business to do private projects to enforce the state program is pretty hefty. Now, the agency did make some changes that addressed part of our concerns. One of them was this idea that we needed to have a better safe harbor. They offered up the 9-factor test as a rebuttable presumption that we can use. The agency also, the Department of Labor and Industry, allows for a one bite at the apple buy, if you will. So if we have a member who happens to have hired a non-registered independent contractor, the Department of Labor and Industry gives us one free oops, right? That doesn't happen with the other agencies that, if you lack of a better word, hijacked delegated authority to DALI. Okay, so what the process that was going on with DALI did not happen with other agencies. That's a concern that we have with making this pilot project permanent, is that you're making permanent something that we don't believe all the bugs have been worked out. The other problem that we have with this, and I'll let Chad Complin, the president of the Builders Association, address this, is just some of the administrative burden and the frustrations that our members have with complying with the law. There is a lot of work that goes into it, and the responsibility truly is on the general contractor or the subcontractor who's verifying another sub. All of that said, Mr. Chairman, there are significant substantive changes to this pilot project. We are being asked to accept a pilot project becoming permanent after it's been amended significantly. And what that is amounting to is you're saying, trust us, we're fixing it, and we can verify later if it's working. We think that defeats the whole point of having a pilot project. That's the reason why we're here fixing this pilot project right now. And a final note, I have to thank Senator Schmidt. We appreciate your willingness to listen to us and accept some of our concerns, even though you may not want to embed them into your bill. We hope that you will at least work further with us to make sure it's a good public policy for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. When you said that the Department of Labor Industry wasn't the only agency that had access to some of this, can you tell us what other agency you feel did?
Yeah, certainly. So the way that this works is that our members go in. Independent contractors have the opportunity to register online for free, easy peasy, right? And then it's incumbent upon a general contractor or a sub who's hiring a sub to go into the state's website and verify if they're an employee or not. And there are practical problems that I'll let Chad talk about. But what has happened with that is an authority that was delegated to DALI has been used by agencies, for example, DEED, to start, if you will, the first step in the audit door is to check the DALI registration website as they're going through the auditing, and then they march down this path of issuing fines to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars out of programs that they ought to be enforcing themselves through their own tools and not be using a pilot project to do that.
Thank you. But under the pilot project right now, they were registering online. Correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, they were.
Thank you. Members, other questions for Ms. Stone? Otherwise, we can hear from Mr. Compton. Mr. Compton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Like Remy said, my name's Chad Compton. I'm fortunate to be the 2014 BAM president. I'm also... Where did I go? I'm fortunate, right?
You're fortunate. Yeah, I'm fortunate. He didn't say unfortunate. Right?
Yeah, no, not unfortunate. But I'm most importantly, I'm a builder in West Central Minnesota. A lot of the problems that we have with this is the compliance. You know, most people think that it's so easy to go in and verify that you're meeting everything that Dolly wants you to meet, and you're required to go on Dolly's website, which I've had conversations with Dolly is kind of archaic and slow, and they've assured me that they're working on that. But you're also supposed to go on to the Secretary of State's website and verify that they are they're registered with them also. Now, I'm fortunate enough to have a full-time secretary to be able to do all of this, but if you're just a two-man operation and you do all your bookwork at night, you know, I just don't. It's a really big burden on small business. And furthermore, our insurance, you know, your general liability insurance comes in and does audits. Your work comp insurance comes in and does audits as far as a general contractor. And they look at all this information. And if our insurance company finds that we don't have, that this person isn't a true independent contractor, they're going to charge us. They'll switch them to a employee on their own. So... there's a lot of checks and balances kind of already in place, as far as I see it. The nine-factor test out in our rural area, almost all of our subcontractors have been subcontractors for many years. And a lot of them never even knew that this program existed. It was up to us as general contractors to go out and tell them that they needed to register. I just had another new one come on. The program's been out 2 years, and we have to tell them to go in and get registered. It just seems like there's a lot of burden put back on the general contractor.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Members have questions for Mr. Compton? Senator
I have some questions, Mr. Chair, but okay. Just in general. So okay. If you have other testimony, we'll wait.
I think that's, unless would someone else like to be heard on the bill? That, okay, come forward, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Matt Marquis. And I represent six different subcontractor associations in the state of Minnesota with over 120 members total. Those are the Carpentry Contractors Association, the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association, Minnesota Environmental Contractors Association, Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association, the Minnesota Painting and Wall Covering Employers Association, and the Thermal Insulation Contractors Association. And they have employ anywhere from a couple employees to a couple hundred employees. These associations were here back in 2012 and actually in 2007 supporting this initiative. They're here again to support that initiative. They see it as working. Misclassification is, in particular in the drywall and flooring industries, a rather large problem as my contractors see it. And so we'd ask that you support 2065 as you have supported the past bills. In addition, Gary Thaden, who unfortunately is testifying in a bill downstairs, asked me to lend the support of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, and there are over 300 contractor members who also supported the bill back in 2012. So we just ask that you support it. We see it as a rather large problem in our industries, and please ask again to pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Marquis. Any questions for Mr. Marquis? Thank you very much for your testimony. And Senator Schmidt, Senate File 2065 is back in front of us. Senator Dames, I believe, had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got kind of a couple of questions here. The first one, I think maybe Mr. Durenberger would, if he would be willing to answer. question here. Mr. Durenberger, during the pilot program, did you find a lot of misclassification that was going on? Give me some idea what you found in percentages or relationships or something that indicate that we have enough violators that requires this type of legislation.
Mr. Chairman, Durenberger? Senator Dames, quite frankly, we didn't see a big change in the types of misclassification or numbers of misclassification that we found before the pilot program compared to after the pilot program. The thing that I think is important to remember about the pilot program is that it was really just a tool to help us with enforcement. So we were still seeing the same types of misclassification. The benefit of the pilot program was now we know who some of these companies are. We know the owners of these companies. We know where they are. So when we find evidence of payments being made to these companies that prior to the registration, we had no way of knowing who these individuals were so that we could do further investigation and identify who they were paying and whether they were paying paying all the benefits that they're supposed to, we now know who they are. And the ones that gave us bad information or refused to cooperate with our investigations, we were able to revoke their registrations as part of a process to make it more difficult for these contractors that don't want to classify their workers properly and provide them with the proper protections afforded under the law to employees, make it more difficult for them to continue to do that. So the pilot program as a tool has been beneficial to helping us identify more of the people that are engaging in violations of law.
Follow-up, Senator Dames. Chair. Mr. Durenberger, so in our small communities, we have a lot of folks that are independent contractors. They have no employees, just themselves. A project comes up, and maybe three of these folks will go together and put in a bid to a general contractor for a project in our area, local community. Is this going to pretty much force them not to be able to do that unless they become somebody's employee when they're actually... Each one is actually an individual contractor, subcontractor.
Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, each of these individuals, if they're acting as a true independent contractor on their own when they bid the job to the general contractor, can be treated as an independent contractor as long as they are doing that. And the law requires that they be registered with us so that we know who they are if they're operating as a limited liability company or a corporation. They've got an invoice under their business name. They can't just have the general contractor write checks to them as an individual, which is an indicator that they're an employee as opposed to a true independent contractor. So, they will have to register. But our point is, and this is, and I think even Mr. Complin talked about this a bit, that it isn't that difficult to register. And it may be difficult sometimes for these smaller contractors to find the time to go online and verify that somebody's registered, but it really is not difficult to do the registration, and it really isn't that difficult once you've done it once or twice to do that verification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another
follow-up
question, and I'm not sure who wants to answer it, Senator Schmidt or Mr. Durenberger, but I'm assuming, I don't see a fiscal note, so I'm assuming that you're indicating that you'll be absorbing the additional labor from the department, you'll just absorb that in your daily, and you won't be adding any employees to do that. Is that a fair assumption?
Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, that's correct. We will be, because we're not asking for a fee, we will be absorbing all of the costs. The registration itself doesn't really cost anything because it's all done online, so it's not expensive. But the enforcement side of it, we're covering that within our division's budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, actually a couple comments and then some questions. I think everybody realizes how important it is that we correctly classify employees. And so as I'm reading this, in light of current events, I just have kind of two basic questions. One revolves around the IT structure, and is that working as intended? Are there times where it's down? Is it difficult to use? We have the Minsure experience behind us, or maybe still in front of us. But so we've seen some real problems with government IT working the way it's supposed to be, and people who really want to comply being able to do so. So I'd like you to speak to that. And I also would like you to speak to data privacy. We all are very interested in data privacy. Is the data that's being collected secure? Is it being used as intended in the bill? I think it said it was intended for Dolly only. So if you can speak to those two issues, the reliability, dependability of the IT, and how the data is currently being used.
Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, first on the IT side, I'm not an IT person, but the investigators that work in this area and are responsible for helping contractors register tell me that every once in a while our system goes down, but it's usually not for more than 10 or 15 minutes at a time, because the registration piece of our website is really a part of the same part of our website that allows any contractor that we license or register in some other fashion to apply for a license or to renew a license online. And that's one of the things we've been pushing hard in labor and industry in the last few years, is to encourage businesses and individuals that we regulate to do their business with us online to minimize cost to them as well as to the agency. So occasionally that we'll have an IT follow-up, but it's nothing that's out of the ordinary, nothing that creates a burden to the contractors. Usually if they have a problem, they call in and our investigator will work with them. And we've had many times where our investigator will actually walk them step by step through the process. So we have the luxury of being able to do that in those few times where people do have problems. So I hope that answers your question, the first question on the IT side.
Mr. Chair, just to add. Well, it does answer it from the department perspective, but I'm going to want to hear from contractors who've actually experienced it. Maybe that will come later in the testimony. But I can speak as someone who has tried to renew licenses online. Sometimes government websites are not easy to navigate. Sometimes they are not user-friendly. And what should take 2 to 5 minutes can take a half hour or an hour, and so that would be some questions maybe from some of the users of the site, and maybe there's someone who wants to think about testifying to that. But the other question then has to do about the data privacy.
Okay. Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the statute as it exists and would continue to exist is very specific about the data and what we can use the data for. And I believe the data that is collected as a part of the registration, the only parts of that data that can be made public are those pieces of data that are made put available on our website on the online license lookup, which essentially is the name of the contractor, their address, and the date that we issued the registration and the date that it expires. We do collect other personal information about these owners of these businesses and the businesses themselves, but that data is not public.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, so it's protected non-public data then. What about other department agencies using this, which was intended for registration verification purposes? Are other agencies tapping into this information?
Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I think what most of the information that these other agencies are getting, deed and revenue, is not necessarily the registration data itself. What they're getting is referrals from our investigative unit, where we have done an investigation of a particular company and its employees or its independent contractors and determined that misclassification occurred and that there were employees that were treated as independent contractors. And so we've made a referral of the investigative data to them because we feel that there's likely an unemployment insurance violation and potentially a tax withholding violation as well. And that was one of the criticisms of state government in the 2007 Legislative Auditor's report, was that workers are being misclassified in the construction industry, and the state agencies that have a role in regulating that do not talk to each other, and therefore there is no effective enforcement of these laws. And that's one of the reasons that we're trying to do this, is make that enforcement, focus it on the bad actors that are repeatedly misclassifying their workers, and make it easier for each agency that has a role in combating that to work together.
Senator Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you'd want to hear testimony now or later, but if there are users of the system in the room who actually have been online and tried to register, I would like to hear from them either now or later. I'd like to know the user experience in the registration.
That's fair. Maybe Mr. Complin, or if you have someone else that would like to answer that question.
I can't personally answer on the registration side, but on the verification side, that's where it's very cumbersome, because I mean, we're a licensed contractor, so we didn't have to go through that registration process. But even to do searches, if I want to go in and I want to verify the license of one of my independent contractors, mm-hmm. It's not like going into Google and typing in their name, by far. You have to be very specific in how you spell it, or it won't show up. You know, like Google, you can go in and put two hash marks or little asterisks and stuff like that. And the system just, it's cumbersome in order to verify. And it is a slow system when you compare it to a lot of other systems out there. So,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in some of my other committees, we've talked about oftentimes how people are listed many different ways. So it could be John B. Smith, or it could be John Smith, or it could be Jonathan Smith, or it could be John Smith III. You know, I think there's, you know, probably seven different ways people could be entered. And so what happens? How do you know which way to enter their name, or does the system automatically pick up that you're talking about the same person, even though maybe there's an initial where it's recorded one place, but maybe in another place it's not? Is there a period after the initial? Isn't there? So there's all these variables that I can see would lend to inaccurate information, and unless the system's able to account for that. Like Google can. It can say, did you mean? But I don't know. Can the system do something like that?
In my personal experience, trying to verify, it can't do that. You have to be very specific. Now, it does have the tool of going either individual or business name, but if you get one, you know, like if you spelled Complin wrong, you wouldn't get it to come up. It wouldn't be there. And unless they've made improvements to the system, I don't know. But that's my last experience, which was probably 2 months ago.
Okay. Thank you.
Come yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Durenberger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I'd like to address that issue because I'm very familiar with the system and the way it works. First of all, one nice thing about it, you don't have to use wildcards. You don't have to put an asterisk or a percentage mark in a name that you're trying to search. When you pull up that search, and this is the exact same search that homeowners use to verify that their remodeler or their home builder or their electrician is licensed. It's the exact same search. So homeowners use this every day to verify that the people that they're hiring to work in their homes are properly licensed. If you just put part of the name in, if I'm looking for Chad's company and I type in K-O-M-P and hit search, I'll find Chad. And I'll find every other licensee in our system that has somewhere in their name the letters K-O-M-P in that sequence. So it may be slow in the sense that now it's doing quite a big search, but we also have search fields where you can check, like Chad said, either a personal license, a business license, or all of our licensees. Then there's a drop-down for the general type of license, electrical, plumbing, residential building contractor, registered contractor. So you have the option of selecting one of those, which will then greatly narrow your focus. And then a second drop-down, which makes it even clearer whether you're looking at, for example, you click on electrical, it gives you Class A electrical contractor, master electrician, journeyman electrician. It gives you all these specific trades. You narrow it down that far, then put in just a part of the name, and you're definitely going to find it. So it is set up to be as comprehensive as possible with typing in as little of the name as possible. And we have instructions right on that web page or on a – it got to be kind of cumbersome. We had so many tips we were trying to give people to be helpful because we want this to be consumer-friendly. So we have a page of tips that go through that. This is what you should do in order to have an effective and efficient experience doing this search.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding Ms. Stone, if I could visit with you a little bit. You mentioned that you had visited or had made a number of comments to Senator Schmidt and things that were not included in here. Is there continuing dialogue to make continued changes in this bill at this point?
Ms. Stone?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. We are continuing to talk about it. The first bite of the apple piece is a good piece for us to continue to talk about. For those of you who aren't aware, subcontractors who fail to register have 30 days to cure that defect. A general contractor who hires somebody who's not registered, under agency policy, they're given a first buy, but literally under the law, they are absolutely responsible on day one, okay? So that's one of the pieces that we really think is super important here. And as you heard from from Mr. Complin. The issue of compliance to the website, we've got a room full of builders in here. All of them just logged on to Dolly's website and they typed in COMP. I don't know if anyone's found Chad's business yet. So we really truly believe that this pilot project needs to remain a pilot project until those bugs are worked out, because these guys have tight time frames. They got a job to do, and they're not going to sit around verifying for 3 hours when they need to move forward. So that's another piece that we really need to explore with the agency and with the senator.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then one other item. You referenced before deed coming in, for example, and issuing fines. Is it the issue of, the Dolly allows one oops and they don't, and that's the things they're coming back on, or are there other items as well?
Primarily, Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, that is probably the greatest concern with the way that this is working. And there are plenty of other ways to do enforcement that deed and revenue and others have, and we just feel that it's a misuse of a pilot project to go down that path. We would like to see if state agencies could be prohibited from using pilot projects to do this kind of activity.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schmidt, I've had, people come in my office for this proposal, people who come in my office against this proposal, and so I've been, listening to people, listening to testimony, and I sent a text to my own general contractor because I'm doing a little bit of work, and he didn't even know about it, number one. And then, so that's a concern to me. If the general contractors aren't familiar with it, then if we turn this into a permanent program, have we really given them enough time to respond to what this would do to impact their business? Because that's always a concern when the real people in the field don't know about it. And then he wanted to know who was administering it, and I explained it was the website, and he did actually write back, and I won't read it, but he did say that he has terrible problems with that website. So that it took his wife once half a day to, get a call back. So, those are anecdotal, and so it does make me wonder about the wisdom of just enacting it fully versus a pilot.
Senator Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, just having listened to all this testimony and the fact that we had some remodeling work done this winter as well, and I didn't even know about this website. I would like to make an oral amendment, and that would be that we do keep it as a pilot site, but at least, there's a lot of changes here, and I can see that the department is making changes here to a program to make it better, which is what we all should be striving to do. But it seems like we should allow these changes to actually be implemented before we would go towards making this any kind of a permanent site. And so I'd like to amend this so that it's 2016, and maybe council can help me. And I would like the recommendations to be then brought back after we've evaluated how the current changes are in effect. I think that might be a line 3.3. And if we change the date from January 1, 2014 to January 1, 2016, would that accomplish the goal of making this a pilot site so we can see how these changes work, then come back and reevaluate?
Well,
I have a question.
Okay, hang on just a second. Senator, Mr. Fuller.
Where were you citing to?
Well, I think I was on the wrong line. But I'm looking for to extend that sunset date. And where is that in the bill? I don't see that anywhere.
Well, it struck out. It's on 3.7. No, it's on 3.7.
Seven.
It's a little more. The difficulty is that the pilot program does not have the components that are proposed by the bill. So extending the pilot, making it a new, you basically would be making it a new pilot program. So I'd have to think about that. You have two choices. You could extend the old pilot program, which I have an amendment for, which is simpler. You'd have to delete everything in the bill and then change the pilot program. Mm-hmm. Or you could pick up the changes in this bill and sunset them in 2 years, which is would require some thought. Give me like 5 minutes to think about it, because it's not as straightforward.
Mm-hmm. So
it's not as simple to do.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson,
my suggestion would be that we table this bill until we get this worked out, so we can really get to the point where we have a chance to really evaluate these changes. How are we going to extend this program in light of these changes? Maybe it's too complicated for us to work on the fly right here. So I'll withdraw my amendment, but move that we table the bill until we get this timeline figured out.
Senator Nelson, I want to hear from the author, obviously, and I think I want to thank members for the discussion. But to the author's point, this bill was introduced on February 27th, the first week of session, and he didn't hear from the builders till last night. So I understand it's our day here today, and obviously I want to hear from Senator Schmidt, but I think we do need to make that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I certainly appreciate, you know, the opportunity to further perfect this bill, and I'm sensitive to folks who have concerns with the bill, with the pilot program, and the prospect of making it permanent. How many P's can we get in there? I don't know. Sorry about that. But I'm not sure that we're going to be able to work out a grand compromise here. I think we've heard from a number of folks today, a number of stakeholders who've been engaged in this discussion for a long time, and they feel pretty good about the movement of this bill and what it would mean and the certainty it would provide for our contractors and builders and other stakeholders alike. I don't want to be mending this on the fly, particularly given the news that just came to us this morning in terms of detailed concern with the bill. I would entertain, I guess, the wisdom of the committee. I mean, if other members have strong concerns or would like to further amend this bill, I'd love to hear from them. Otherwise, I know with committee deadlines looming, we don't have a lot of time to be laying bills on the table and picking them back up. So if
let's just – Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question, okay. If we're going to questions.
That's
again.
Fine. I think we're okay. Good.
And this would be for Ms. Stone.
I'll take this side for you. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. When you were speaking just a few minutes ago, you mentioned that subcontractors, if they're not registered, have 30 days to correct that. Okay. But in law, that general contractors – I can't remember your exact word, but we're responsible right away. Can you tell me what that all would mean for a general contractor?
Ms. Stone.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator, what that means is for a general contractor, we've violated the law immediately with no right essentially to cure under the way that the bills, the current programs run. Which means then, of course, we potentially have violated the one safe harbor that we have to prove that we haven't hired an employee. And so along with all of that misclassification comes the burden of unemployment insurance, the benefits for employees or independent contractors. So we have all sorts of other requirements under state law that we've then violated. And it can be pretty significant. And ironically, the responsibility to enforce is on the general contractor. So if we find a subcontractor who's not registered, we say you got to register in order for you to be in compliance. And we give them all that opportunity, and then the agency is able to give them an additional 30 days. Now, there is the safe harbor that we're working on in this bill that would default to the 9-factor test also. But again, we've heard that there are many people who don't know anything about this law, general contractors or subcontractors. So we need to do a much better job making sure that everybody knows how to comply with the classification issues under that we want in this state.
Okay, Senator Coonan.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Stone, I understand what you said, what that all entails, but
yeah.
Along with that, are they penalties or fines or anything like that, too? Or?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Coonan, yeah, actually there are. And if you look at the back page of the the report that was provided from the agency, you can see the whole host of violations that happen where fines have been levied. And I'm not saying that that's okay, that we've got violations under state law. We don't want that. But there needs to be a much better way for us to do that. I just lost my train of thought, so I'll just stop.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's helpful. Thank you, Ms. Stone.
Thank you, Senator Cooner. Senator Schmidt, we don't have a motion in front of us, but we've had some discussion, and I think that they would like to maybe lay the bill over and continue to do some work. I think we could bring it back up Monday if that's something that would be
I'm certainly amenable to doing that, and we can try to work out our differences. I just emphasize the fact that I think folks have been talking about this bill for some time now, and I think there just may be some differences that we may have trouble getting past. And I also would emphasize the fact that I think there's a great value in making a pilot that does demonstrate a benefit permanent, just in terms of providing certainty for all stakeholders involved. So perhaps, you know, if we do decide to lay this on the table, that we do we have some conversations about how to improve it, and rather than extending the pilot status, you know, put in some safeguards here that make folks comfortable putting this in a permanent statute. And I think that would be the direction I'd urge folks to go here, rather than, you know, kicking the can forward on this decision. I think it certainly offers some benefit here. I understand the concern with the technology in place, and I would hope that that's a continuing emphasis for improvement moving forward. I don't know if there's any, you know, I would, again, welcome any other thoughts from the committee. Otherwise, I'm happy doing that.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to say like to agree with Senator Nelson, Senator Bonhoff. We have a lot of folks that aren't even aware of this, and obviously we haven't done a good job of educating our general contractors, getting the word out to them, and you know, working on some of the details that were talked about today. By Monday is probably possible, but we're not going to work out details such as getting the general contractor to understand this. We're not going to have a website that's going to be working better by Monday. So I'm not convinced that Monday is the option. I still think we need to look at extending this so that everything is in place so that when we really start going after it, it's done correctly and done properly. I think as a state, we have that obligation, and I think as a committee here, we have the obligation to put the best product we can, the best legislation on the books we can, and I don't feel we're doing that today. So I would like to see this thing extended out a while so we get an opportunity to do that.
Okay, thank you. That's fair. And I think that, Senator Schmidt, I think if it's okay with you, we will lay the bill over.
That's fine. That's
fine. Make time for you on Monday, and I think that that's good, committee, because I think that it is important that we have jurisdiction over these issues, and we should do the work here. So,
and Mr. Chair and committee members, I have had a chance to have a couple of conversations today about this from folks on different sides of the issue, and I'd welcome that dialogue to continue and hope that we're able to agree on a compromise here moving forward.
So with that, then, thank you, members, and we'll lay Senate File 2065 on the table. Thank you very much, Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, committee.
Senator Tomassoni, Senate File 2124.
Can you like that?
He changes or?
I don't know. He said he was going to, but sorry, but I mean,
I understand.
Yeah, we are.
Senator Tomassoni, whenever you're ready, we'll hear Senate File 2124.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we have an amendment that I have to put on it first, Mr. Chairman, to make it peace in the valley. And The one I have is an A140851. Is that what you have? No? Okay. That's because this one needed to be changed a little bit. Okay.
Okay, so this would just be an author's amendment, Senator Thomas, sorry,
yes.
The bill in the
yes.
shape that you'd prefer?
Yes, and it's so it's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
A1 amendment that's coming around. Senator Coonan, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, so moved.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Tomasoni, to your bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what I'm going to do is I'll let the department describe the bill. This bill is a federal conformity bill as well as an apprenticeship rights bill. And it's my understanding that with the amendment and with the bill itself that people are comfortable with it and that it's all been worked out. So I'll let the department go ahead and give you an accurate description of what's in the bill.
Deputy Commissioner Luman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just by way of background, just want to sort of do the 101 on registered apprenticeship. I know many of you heard this from Commissioner Peterson at a different committee in the Senate last week. But just as a reminder, DLI is granted the authority to be the registered apprenticeship agency for the state of Minnesota from the U.S. Department of Labor. Registered apprenticeship itself is a formal system of employee training that combines on-the-job training with related technical instruction. And it's specifically designed to take workers from entry level to experienced workers while training them in skills and safety training, and they can earn while they learn. Just as an update on where we are in registered apprenticeship, we have about 7,600 registered apprentices today. 542 of those are females, and 1,365 are minorities. This is an area we're really trying to focus in terms of increasing opportunity for women minorities in registered apprenticeship programs. Apprenticeship in Minnesota, as well as around the country, is still predominantly in the construction trades. That's because it's a cultural and historical phenomenon that this is a great way of training workers in specific trade work. Currently, the five largest apprenticeship programs that we have, which cover about 60% of the registered apprentices, are in the construction trades, and those are things like construction laborers, carpenters, electricians, sheet metal workers, roofers, plumbers. We also have non-construction programs in Minnesota, and those are growing, and that's an area where we're really trying to put more emphasis and focus on getting more non-construction-based programs because this is a great learning model. And so we have different programs like refrigerator mechanic and power line workers and firefighters and industrial sewers and other programs like that of registered apprenticeship. What this bill does is it really gets us in conformity with the federal regulations that give us the authority to administer these programs. We at the Department of Labor and Industry register apprenticeship programs, help employers design apprenticeship programs and the standards and core curriculums that go inside of those. And then we also register and ensure the training for each individual apprentice. We've worked really hard with our apprenticeship sponsors to make sure that this bill meets the requirements of the federal regulations and continues to meet the specific needs of employers and employees in Minnesota. I could walk you through the bill. Most of it is very, very technical. And really what it does is it allows us to continue to regulate these apprenticeship programs and ensure that they do meet the fundamental requirements of providing training to workers.
Can I just run through it briefly? That'd be great.
Sure. So the section-by-section piece of it, Section 1 really improves our definitions. It combines the required language from the federal law with the current Minnesota law and rules. Section 2, it details the agency responsibility that we must act as a state apprenticeship authority. Section 3 continues to have, we have an apprenticeship advisory board, and that board will continue to operate and provide advice and counsel and be a representative of the entire apprenticeship industry. We have representatives on that board from labor, from employers, from educators. It's a great board where we can have really good discussions about apprenticeship training. The Section 4 allows us to just basically clean up the language that clarifies how one of the challenges that we have under the current law is that there's apprenticeship programs and standards and apprenticeship agreements, and in the current law those have been blended, and we're trying to clarify that there are two, that these are two separate things. Sponsors and employers put together the standards, and then individual apprentices enter into apprenticeship agreements. And so that's what their rights and responsibilities are under that program. Under the Minnesota Apprenticeship Act, the apprentices are also covered by a wage progression. They, because they're earning while they're learning, they are starting at a lower wage and they're working their way up. And we have combined here both policy and department policy as well as rule and statute to make it very clear how the wage schedule is included in the apprenticeship agreement. And again, that's basically so the apprentice can know what deal they're getting as part of their training program. And then it also gives the bill also gives the department the very clear authority about how we can address programs that aren't providing the training that they've promised to registered apprentices, and really giving them an opportunity to remedy any deficiencies and get on the right path so that they can provide that training.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Any questions for Senator Tomasoni or Deputy Commissioner Lumen at this time?
Yes, Ms. Lohman, I just have a question. You mentioned there's 1,365 minority in the apprenticeship program. What's the percentage of ratio?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Herr, we're actually really pleased that we're almost at 18% of our registered apprentices are minorities. That is an improvement, and we continue to see improvement. And it is an area where we are, as I say, putting a lot of emphasis in the high school programs as well as in early career exposure to help apprenticeship programs attract more minority participants.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, we had a whole hearing yesterday about a different type of apprenticeships we're calling in the higher ed workforce development side, which will be coming to this committee and that committee. We're calling the Pipeline Project, and we're really doing that so that we can have be free from some of the constraints around the federal program. But I just want you to know I hear so many wonderful things about what you're doing and about the way that Dolly runs the apprenticeship program and you in particular. So thank you for your work, and I look forward to seeing if we can't expand upon that but approach it in other industries.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Tomasoni. Page 6, subdivision 5, 6.1 down to 6.13. Can you tell me where that language is coming from? Who's encouraging that language? I understand that we're doing federal conformity issues. Where that language is coming from?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this language, the notice language, is that what you mean? This language causes a lot of questions, so I appreciate you raising it. This language is in current federal law and is in current Minnesota law, and this language only states, the effect of this language is that if there is a collective bargaining representative at the place of employment where the apprenticeship program is starting, that they be given notice that there's going to be a registered apprenticeship program. So if there is no collective bargaining representative at that place of employment, this provision doesn't apply.
A follow-up, Mr. Senator Chair. Davis. If it's already in state statute, why are we putting it in here then as new language?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dame, one of the things we've done in this bill, and as Senator Tomasoni says, there's a lot of pages here. We've reordered and moved around a lot of pieces to make it more clear. And this provision is currently in, and I don't want to tell you wrong, is currently in is in 178.03, subdivision 3. And we didn't include all of the language that we were striking out, so it's you'll see it in the repealer when we've, because it was already a long bill. You'll see it in the repealer, but we've really just removed the language from one place to another to make it very clear that it applies to the standards piece as opposed to the apprenticeship agreement piece.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson, do you have a question?
Oh, actually, that was my question, too. Okay. If it's already current law, why are we seeing it here?
Okay.
And where is the – I guess I do have a question. I'm looking in the back here of the repealers. So where is this language that you're inserting in 6.1 through 6.13? Where is that repealed? I don't see the repealer repealing that language somewhere else. I thought that's what you said. You're repealing it somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I believe that the language isn't in the repeal. I'm going to try to find it. I'm finding it. It's you find it? Senator, yeah, I think she's looking over here.
What page are you on, Senator Nelson?
Yeah. Well, I'm looking for the part of the bill we were just talking about, 6.1 through 6.13, it looks like new language, but it's current law, and I thought I understood the assistant commissioner to say that it looks like it's new language even though it's current law because we're repealing it somewhere else. So I'm just looking for the repealer.
And I'm trying to find it for you, Senator. We changed the name of it because it was really confusing. It used to say union notice. And so that's why I'm trying to find it. And I'd be happy to show it to you again. And I also it is also in federal law. If you would let me show that to you. I don't see it in the appendix here. I didn't have the appendix before. So I don't see it in the appendix here, but I believe it is in the repealer of Minnesota rules. But I thought it was in statute, so I'm going to tell you wrong.
Just, Deputy Commissioner, I think maybe Mr. Knopf might have some insight that could help us a little.
That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members, I was looking for the language because I didn't see it in the repealers either, but if you look on 4.32, there is some language related to unions who jointly form a sponsoring entity on a multi-state basis. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to. Or if it's something else.
It's different. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to look it up in the current statute and provide that information to you. I assure you it is current language, and I'm just not finding it right now. And I assure you it is also in 29 CFR 29, which is the regulation that we're required to comply with.
Thank you. They'll be fine.
Thank you.
Ms. Senator Nelson. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Any further questions for Senator Tomasoni or the Commissioner? If not, Senator Bonner would like to move that Senate file 2124 as amended be recommended to pass, and it can go to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sharon, I know, has been working. I don't know if she... Oh, here she is. Senator Sharon has Senate file 2000. Senator Sharon, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much. I am here with Senate File 2000. Members of the committee, this particular piece of legislation is a part of an overall Women's Economic Security Act. I would like to have you refer to the language of the bill. You can see it's quite simple. What it adds is language on, as it relates to nursing mothers, on lines 1.4 through 1.16 that expands and clarifies the obligation of the employer's reasonable efforts to provide a room or other location in close proximity to the work area, other than a bathroom or a toilet. Before it was just a toilet stall. And so what we're adding is that it, other than a bathroom or a toilet stall, that is shielded from view and from the intrusion of coworkers and the public and that includes access to an electrical outlet. And then the second part of the bill that I want to draw your attention to is that under 1.20, it speaks to the remedy of violation of this section is an unfair employment practice as provided under the sections of law that relate to human rights. That really is the essence of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Do you have a witness with you, too, that would like to testify on behalf of Senate File 2000?
Yes.
Okay. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lisa Stratton. I'm an attorney and the executive director of Gender Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm based here in St. Paul. We offer legal representation and counsel as well as policy advocacy for anyone in the state who feels they've been discriminated against or faced a barrier to their success based on their gender. So we represent men and women and others gender identified of any sort. We focus on cases where stereotyping is the problem and someone's being prevented from having their full the full enjoyment of their employment or whatever other the context is based on a gender stereotype type or perception about them that is not based on them but on a notion of how they either should be or will be. And this bill came out of an experience we had when a young Minnesota mother came to us. Her name is Tara Duncan, and she came to us and told us a story about what had happened to her. She'd been an incredibly dedicated employee in a chiropractor's office. She'd been working for years, and when she had her second baby, she wanted to nurse her baby. Anyone who's had a baby in the last 20 years can probably tell you that the messages are loud and clear and strong that to be a good mother, you need to be breastfeeding your baby. The posters are up everywhere about the health benefits and how important it is for the bonding and for the infant's health. And so she, like many young mothers, wanted to continue. She only had 4 weeks of leave with her baby because she only could take unpaid leave. And so she had it calculated that that's how long she could stay out of the workplace. When she returned, she planned to take a couple of short breaks during the day to express breast milk to save to feed to her new baby during the day, the next day, which is a practice I think probably everyone's familiar with. And when she said she was going to do that, her boss said, I don't want you to. I think that's going to interfere with our business, and I don't have to. The law doesn't make me. She had been planning to even work while she was pumping. She was answering phone calls the first day. She had made a copy of the scheduling book and brought it back with her. There was a little room available that wasn't otherwise used. But there was some kind of hostility toward her for simply wanting to do that, and he refused. And she had to make a choice between keeping her job, which her family depended on for their livelihood, or nursing her baby. And I can tell you when she called us how distraught that choice made her. And she actually came up to the cities for the Women's Economic Security Summit that we held and spoke and told her story. But I am, since it is a ways away, she drove 5 hours that day to speak, but I'm sort of here in her stead. As the senator described, the bill is very simple. It requires just basically the provision of short breaks and a clean space that is private enough to allow you to at least temporarily use it to express breast milk. And the statute has actually existed since 1998. Senator Ellen Anderson authored it when it was first passed. And so we were actually in Minnesota on the forefront on this issue. It is now law for large employers under the Affordable Care Act also. And this language far predates, obviously, the Affordable Care Act, but it is now law on the federal level as well. But what I learned when I represented Tara was that there is no enforcement mechanism for this law. It's a law that exists. It's a right without a remedy. And So we promised Tara at Gender Justice that we would work on that. And when the Women's Economic Security Act came up, we proposed that this law be changed to add, to do some clarifications and to add the enforcement mechanism. The one that we have, that we is in the bill that you have, is basically just points toward the Minnesota Human Rights Act for the enforcement scheme, because then the reasoning for that is that it's a well thought out and clearly detailed scheme of enforcement that is used for pregnancy accommodations and other related kinds of workplace issues. And because it has an informal procedure where one can bring, you file a charge, the department responds and investigates and gives its opinion as to whether there's been a violation, rather than the only choice being to bring a private lawsuit or something immediately. We wanted a mechanism, because this needs to happen quickly. I wanted a mechanism where there would be a quick interaction between the employee and the employer that could hopefully lead to resolution. In other places in California where they've had a similar law with a similar enforcement scheme, but around pregnancy accommodations, they have found that advocacy organizations like Gender Justice that exist there are able to deal with most of the complaints, most of the noncompliance by employers, really very quickly with a phone call or a letter, and it solves the problem. So we urge you to put a remedy with this right, with this important right, and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stratton. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About a month after we adjourned last year, I became a grandpa for the first time, so I've become a little more aware of some of these issues again and that type of thing. but I do want to comment. I'm going to give you my example of my own business office back home. I have three offices. I have a reception area and workspace area, and it turns into an L, and then it leads into a bathroom. Been remodeled, fairly nice. I'm in an older building downtown Laverne. The basement is an old, tells you it's an old building. I could not make, when everyone's there working, I could not meet the letter of this law based on how this is written. Now, I understand it says must make reasonable efforts. I also know that at times reasonable varies from one person to the next. You understand what I'm saying. Now, this is not going to be an issue in my office at this time. If it is, we're actually going to make the news probably based on the age of the people that work there. But you understand what I'm saying. I mean, it's physically impossible. Unless one of the individuals wasn't in their office, that one, could be available at that time. But you can never guarantee that. I mean, it's not a for sure thing, at any given time. So, okay, where do we go with something like this?
Ms. Stratton?
We're going to talk about reasonable accommodations.
The concept of reasonableness, Mr. Chair and Senator, is a fairly common one in the law, and especially in employment law, where you have factual situations that vary so much from case to case. It's so difficult to write out exactly what should be required. There's no intent in the statute, and it has been around since 1998 without causing big issues of the kind that you raise that I know of. It does not anticipate anyone having to build a structure they don't already have. It doesn't require, it just requires the best to bring your best effort and some creativity to it, I think. Mm-hmm. Under the federal law, when they have issued some regulations since the ACA, it is suggested that if you have private spaces, like if you have three people who have private offices, we're talking about a 15-minute period a couple times a day, that maybe it would be reasonable just to make sure that the woman could use one of the offices, just for that short of time at those points in the day. I can't imagine a court saying it would have to be the same place in the same office every time. And I don't think that's how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be a working out of what is reasonable. And courts apply reasonableness all the time. And I've been an employment law litigator for more years than you probably think. And I have never, I perceive that myself as a litigator as a very business-friendly standard, because that's how the courts see it. You know, they don't like to hold themselves out as judging companies and employers by any kind of unreasonable standard or run their business. There's lots of case law that says when they apply standards like this, they're not to try to run your business. And they take that seriously in the courts, is my experience.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, thank you for bringing this forward. My kids are now 29, 26, 25, 23, so it's been a long time. But I remember when I was a young working mother, it was so embarrassing. I mean, that's like the one thing I think about is just feeling embarrassed. And so here we are, you know, all these years later, and we're talking about it in a Senate hearing. And I appreciate that, because it really, you know, as a woman executive early on, it was difficult. So I appreciate what you're doing. I also have heard some concerns around the route that you've chosen in terms of the enforcement. So I mentioned to you that I, you know, wanted to offer a different remedy, and so I would like to do that with an amendment. And I have the A3. The concern that I have heard with regard to the remedy is that it's pretty onerous in terms of it does take you through the whole court system rather than using a remedy that we could ask the department to enforce, which would be more of a, we hope, a fee that would be a burden. And so I'm offering the A3, but I actually am going to have a couple oral changes to the A3 after I read it more closely. So, because I had taken a previous one and made some changes. So I have the A3, and Mr. Chair, if I could make some oral amendments to the A3.
Okay.
So what the A3 does is it says that the enforcement mechanism would be that the Department of Labor and Industry will enforce it, and it says the department may, and I would strike may and insert will, assess a fine of, and I would strike up to, and it says $1,000 for a violation of this section, and then it says a fine instead of may, I would again strike may and put will, be assessed only if an employer fails to remedy a violation within 15 days of notice from the department. So the if there's a infraction, the department would give notice, and the company would have 15 days to remedy, and if they don't remedy, then they would get a $1,000 fine.
Just to make sure we're clear, obviously, I'm with Senator Sharon, I want to hear your comments too, but can we just make sure that council has those oral changes and so that members are comfortable too with what Senator Bonner is trying to do? Mr. Fuller?
Well, there's one. On line 7, I don't think you want will. I think you want shall there.
Okay.
As well. And then would you like a little discussion on the up to one or not, Senator Bonner? Well, the concept of up to is not uncommon, such as in OSHA, because you look at the size of the employer.
Mm.
And so, I mean, and the severity of the violation.
Okay.
So it's not uncommon in the labor law enforcement area that you do have that concept, because there are varying degrees of culpability. And so if you're a large corporation, there's a continued pattern of doing it, it could be a larger fine. If you're a smaller employer and you're really having difficulty complying for some, you know, reasonable reason, that's not enough not to do it, but it's hard to do it, you know, then maybe it could be
latitude.
A smaller fine. So that's the reason behind that language.
Okay.
And I mean, I understand what you said, but yeah, that's the reason behind it.
Chair, I would take counsel in that regard, and so would insert shall rather than the will, and leave in up to, and then again, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fuller, I would suggest the second may would also go to shall.
That's fine.
Senator Sharon?
Yes. We would like to have an opportunity to speak a bit about this proposal. I would have Lisa Stratton talk about the engagement that she is having with the Chamber of Commerce about shifting the enforcement process from the human rights language to this section of law, and why this particular, while the issue of shifting is not so much as at dispute with the representatives here, but the exact language in which that should be implemented as an amendment is still in process, and we'd like to be able to talk about that with you and show you why although the idea of moving this to another part of law is not totally objectionable, the rest of the amendment is, and what its limitations are. And with that, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd have Lisa talk further about that.
Ms. Stratton, and I should just apologize, too. This amendment came kind of quick. We did have someone from the chamber that maybe wanted to testify. So maybe after you respond, we can see if anyone else would like to be heard on the bill, too. But that's fine. Ms. Stratton, maybe if you just want to comment on the amendment that's in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I said something about why I thought the Department of Human Rights was the right place for this enforcement mechanism, and the commissioner is aware of this bill, and we've been speaking to the commissioner about it, and they favor the bill as is my understanding. I also, though, think it is extremely important that this bill have, that this law have some teeth, and I don't think that what's been offered instead, it has enough teeth. Most of my professional life, I've spent representing employees, trying to enforce their rights, and I have never seen anyone do anything based on a letter from the Department of Labor. And once we're into the need for enforcement, we're already not talking about the typical employer. We're talking about a recalcitrant employer who knows this law exists and is just refusing to comply, because no lawyer even writes a letter to the Department of Labor for an employee without talking to the employer first. It always starts with a letter and an exchange, and most problems can be solved there. So we're already in the enforcement section dealing with an employer that's refusing to comply, knowing that this is the law. And so the $1,000 fine could easily just be a cost of doing business. And the Department of Labor does not do a lot of, other than wage and hour, doesn't do a lot of investigative work about the facts of what's happening in a workplace, which the Department of Human Rights does. In terms of the conversations we've been having, right up until before the hearing, we had been talking, the business groups, the chamber and others, and myself and other members of the coalition supporting the bill, about their concern about the Department of Human Rights having jurisdiction. And I have looked at Chapter 181. I think there are other parts of Chapter 181, for example, the personnel. The part of 181, which is a rather random collection of employee rights and employer duties, and vice versa, there is a section of Chapter 181 that gives the employee the right to get a copy of their own personnel file and to dispute things in it if they want to, and the employer has a duty then to put the material in the file. So that section has an enforcement scheme that has much more teeth than what's being proposed for this arguably much more fundamental human right of being able to keep nursing when you have a baby and have to work. This one provides for Department of Labor jurisdiction, which is more typical of that chapter, 181, which happens to be where this nursing mother's law was placed initially. But it provides for fines of $5,000 for violations, and it allows the department to seek to bring a civil action in the name of the department, the Commissioner of Labor. And if all else fails, it also provides for a private remedy. And it also has a retaliation provision, which would be lost completely if that's all part of the whole enforcement scheme under the Human Rights Act includes. You can't retaliate against someone just for trying to enforce their rights. And if this amendment passed, there'd be no such protection in this bill. Because if you're writing your own a separate remedial scheme, you need an anti-retaliation provision in there. So I we were working on this and talking back and forth, and at this stage there was no agreement. So I understand the amendment's been opposed, but we prefer that the bill go forward as is and can continue the conversation. It'll be heard in Judiciary on Friday, and I suspect we'd be able to reach something closer to agreement rather than just the chamber's request.
So our preference would be that that this committee understand that the enforcement process is reviewed in Judiciary. It is their area, and that it is a process that's in continual discussion. And I'm sure that the interested parties will be communicating with our members about this at that time.
Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to speak on behalf of the amendment. I can support this amendment. I think it's a good amendment. And I think we're really traveling down a slippery slope when we take what we're talking about here and start looking at that as being a human rights violation. I can understand it should be a labor violation. I think it turned into a human rights violation. I think we're going down a slippery slope. And I think as a committee, we have an obligation here to get the bill in the best shape we can. You know, all we're hearing this session is, well, we'll take care of it at the next committee. We'll take care of it at the next committee. And, folks, it's not happening. So if it's going to get taken care of, let's take care of it here. And if it won't get taken care of here, just passed out the way that the author would prefer, that's fine. But at least we've done what we need to do here. And I don't like passing bills on when we know there's objections. Either table the bill and get the objections worked out, or let's correct the bill here and move it forward.
Sure enough, point well taken. I think we should hear from the chamber, too, because I think Ms. Cadoon was on our list to testify. So,
I can stay. It's too long. Sorry. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. If it's okay, I also brought up Melissa Raffan. Along, she is an employment law attorney, so I think it's very important to get her perspective as well, because she's obviously much more well-versed in this area of law than I am. As I mentioned, Beth Cadoon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. We did have concerns with this bill as written, and our concern was related to the remedy that was put in this bill regarding the human rights, that it would be now a remedy under the Human Rights Act. We are certainly supportive of this amendment put forth by Senator Bonoff. We think this is a good compromise that does allow a remedy in law. We do believe the Department of Labor is certainly able to enforce this, and this is a substantial fine that would be put on. And I also think the other issue is for nursing mothers, obviously you want to have a quick action. And we think the fine and the 15 days would provide a much more quick action that could occur and get this remedied so you can take care of the situation quicker than a human rights violation would. With that, if it's fine with the chair, I'd like Melissa to comment on the remedies portion.
Good afternoon. I'm Melissa Raffan, and I am a partner with Dorsey & Whitney. I, too, have practiced in the employment law area for over 25 years, and I'm here as general counsel to the Minnesota Employment Law Council. I agree in terms of the remedy. I think the remedy, the amendment that's been proposed, achieves exactly what the proponents of the bill are setting out to do. They say that right now the statute has no teeth, absolutely no enforcement mechanism. So the question is, what would be the appropriate enforcement mechanism? We don't oppose having an enforcement mechanism, and having an enforcement mechanism that has notice and opportunity to cure and a fine if it's not cured is appropriate, particularly since the idea is to actually see a change in the behavior. And if a company is hauled into court and is forced to defend a lawsuit, they're not going to have money to make the change that the statute is demanding. So the amendment achieves exactly that which it sets out to do. I would simply ask if it would be possible to say within 15 days of written notice of a violation from the department.
We can take that under advisement. Senator Bonoff's amendment, so I guess you'd have to take that under consideration. We can certainly ask counsel if that's something that would make
sense, but.
Question.
Yeah, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, question for Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon, I think what you're hearing is that the members aren't comfortable sending it out in a form that we aren't supporting because we're going to vote for it. And so we do want to make our change. But so I'd like more feedback from you in terms of, is the $1,000, you know, something that you think is the right number? And just, you know, in terms of the written, I don't, that seems fine with me.
Was the material that I asked to be copied distributed to the members of the committee?
Yes.
So you have that. I gave it to you. What you're looking at here is a, I think it's just in black and white. There's not anything yellow here. But if you would look at section 181.964, 181.9641, and then on this turnover to 181.965, what the advocates are looking at, it, to be responsive to the chamber's concern that this be addressed outside of the human rights ordinance, is to apply these sections rather than what you have described in your amendment, Senator Bonoff, because it is a much stronger statement of enforcement. The fine is up to $5,000, so there is more strength to it, and it also addresses what is missing in your amendment, which is called retaliation prohibition, which is very important to this whole process. So, and the reason that I was that this is in process. This is a conversation in process, and I would hate to have us. I mean, it's up to the committee, of course, what you're going to do. I think that you're hearing the advocates indicate that they're trying to work with the appropriate placement for the enforcement process, but are trying to find a way that meets their concerns, which are, you know, a strength to the penalty to make a clear statement of seriousness, and also to create language that doesn't allow an employer retaliation. So we would prefer, if you were going to make an amendment, to have it be to transfer one the language or refer to enforcement to follow 181.964, 181.9641, and 181.965.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
And Michelle, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last name.
Melissa Rafan.
Melissa, I apologize. And Mr. Rafan, can you comment to Senator Sharon's suggestions?
Yes, I would like the opportunity to do that. Chapter 181 is a chapter that has a number of different employment provisions. Each one has its own enforcement mechanism, such that this is an opportunity to create the enforcement mechanism that best matches the right. In this instance, we have understood that there is no enforcement mechanism, so having one in the first place is a movement from where it's been. In the second place, it's one that needs an enforcement mechanism that will move quickly. And so notice and an opportunity to cure, and if in 15 days there's been no change, there's a penalty, seems like exactly the appropriate kind of enforcement mechanism that you would want for this statute.
Mr. Chair. How about the retaliation prohibited? I mean, that is a concern. Sometimes, you know, there's something happens in a company, and I hear from constituents who call me and say, then it was very uncomfortable to work. They, you know, did different things so that I ended up not able to keep my job.
So I think what I would say is this. In terms of retaliation prohibited, that truly is a completely different action. That is an action that is applicable, you know, I'm going to say there are existing laws to address retaliation already. There are existing laws under the Human Rights Act. There are existing laws under the state whistleblower law. If you believe that they're violating a law, then you can use existing enforcement mechanisms, and I don't think that the legislature has to keep creating laws to do the same thing. So I would say that's unnecessary.
Thank you.
Mr.
Fuller, I think, maybe has something that can help us clarify.
Well, two things. I think the addition of written is fine. You have a documentary trail, then, so you might want to move that for inclusion.
So moved.
Yeah. And then I have a question. Is it Ms. Rafan?
Yes.
Could you tell the committee if the Human Rights Act protects against sexual discrimination in employment practices?
Ms. Rafan?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota Human Rights Act protects or prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender as well as several other categories of protected classes. And so gender discrimination is already illegal under the state's Human Rights Act.
Mr. Fuller?
In your opinion, and I don't know the answer, it's not a trick question, is would a retaliation against a woman for asserting her right to, under this law, rise to the level, as the law currently stands, as a sexual gender discrimination under the Human Rights Act?
Well,
if
Mr. Speaker, so the question is, if a woman asked her employer to comply with the provisions of this act, would that constitute protected activity? I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to, I suppose, say it depends. But if the question is, my point is, there is a remedy existing already under law because a woman could file a claim under the Whistleblower Protection Act. If you identify that a law has been broken and you put yourself in the category of a whistleblower, then you are protected. Would it constitute protected activity under the Minnesota Human Rights Act? That I can't answer.
I could attempt, actually, if I
Ms. Stratton.
Permit.
Ms. Stratton.
Ms. Stratton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to know that sex discrimination has not worked at all in the law in this country to protect women's to protect nursing as an activity. I can quote from a case from a state Supreme Court that said lactation is not a condition of pregnancy. So not protected under the sex and pregnancy anti-discrimination provisions. A lactation suit brought as a sex discrimination case was rejected by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal court, because it did not involve, it was not pregnancy, childbirth, or a related medical condition. So there is a gap here, and it was filled in 1998 by this legislature, and that's a good thing. The question is how to make it work for Minnesota women, and the fact, what would motivate employers to do that? The question of speed, well, the Minnesota Human Rights Act has a charge procedure and a 10 days for the employer to respond. It has the same kind of speed, but it is important that there be a hook, that there be something that an advocate can use to say, you've got to do this or else. And I don't think a letter from the Commissioner of Labor, no matter whether a fine is $1,000 or less or not, is necessarily going to motivate a company that doesn't want to do this in the first place. And that's who we're talking about.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that it, given the grayness of that area, I would ask Mr. Fuller, would it work for us to just add retaliation prohibited to this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, I see no problem with adding that as a technical structural matter. It's a policy decision. So you would say something to the effect, put on my reading glasses.
And Senator Sharon,
Bonoff.
Go ahead.
No, you're right.
Senator Sharon, I know, you know, your preference was to bring this to judiciary, but we have made a decision as committee members that we didn't want to let things out. And so I guess your other option would be to table it and work and try and bring agreement if you didn't want to do this work here. But
okay, so
Mr. Fuller,
Mr. Chairman, the motion would be: see, we amended the bill, so we would on page 1, line after line 19, insert a new clause D, and then I would turn to the law that was distributed. And say an employer, so then it would read, an employer may not retaliate against an employee for asserting rights or remedies under this section.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon? Incorporated into it? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
That improves the amendment.
Thank you. Senator Dames?
I think at some point, I think we have an amendment, and we have one or two changes to the amendment, so at some point, we're going to have to vote on these amendments. Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Chair, can we have the amendment?
Senator Nelson. Oh, that's okay. I'm just.
Yes. Could we have the amendment, I think it was the A3, as amended with all the changes that Senator Bonoff has incorporated into her amendment? Could we have that read for the record and for us, please?
Yep. I think that's a very good point. Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, members, so we have the A3 amendment. It reads, as it reads down to 1.7, where the word may is deleted and shall is inserted. And on line 8, may is deleted and shall is inserted. And on page 8 again, after of, insert written. And then after line 1.4 of the amendment, say page 1 after line 19. So that would be after page line 3 of the amendment. Insert D, paragraph D, so a D, small letter D in parentheses. An employer may not retaliate against an employee for asserting rights or remedies under this section. And if I have the lines wrong, I assume the committee will approve the secretary to put them in the right spot.
Okay. Helpful. That's a pretty big amendment, but members comfortable?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson?
I speak in favor of this amendment. I think the committee has done its work. It's listened to the testifiers. It's answered the objections. We want to get to the heart of what Senator Sharon wants to do here, and we want the remedy to be in a timely manner, and I feel that this amendment does that as it has been revised.
Senator Dames?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I also support the amendment. Senator Sharon, clean this up, and I think it's a good amendment.
Before we take action, Senator Sharon, would you like to comment further on the A3 amendment?
Well, the committee is going to do its work. Our preference is to have this remain under the Human Rights Ordinance, and that you remember that this is viewed in terms of how we value or treat women, and right now is this amendment, which I think you're going to support, indicates that we probably would impose a stricter fine if somebody doesn't make your personnel file available to you than you will if an employer does not comply with this law.
Okay. Further discussion, members? Otherwise, I think there is a motion before us. Senator Bonoff?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I was really wanting to get a little more information from you. Like, for example, did you want the $1,000 to be higher?
I think that the $1,000 should be the first lob, and it can be no. You've changed it and improved it to say it will be $1,000, but it could be $5,000 if it would fit with what the advocates are recommending.
Senator Nelson.
Or Mr. Chair, I think one of the items that I jotted down was or a $2,000 fine for repeated violations, something to address that concern. But my concern is that we not take well-intended legislation and put it in a section of law that is good for attorneys, you know, present company accepted here, but that is good for attorneys, but doesn't really get to the heart of the issue, which is getting an immediate change and remedy. And so if it would make, you know, the author of the bill more comfortable, I'm more than glad to offer a further amendment, which is regarding repeated violations, $2,000 fine for repeated violations.
Senator Sharon?
Of course, that would be an improvement. And the higher the number, the better. So $5,000 would be my recommendation.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, for right now, I'll amend the A3 to include a $2,000 fine for repeated violations.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, understanding the amendment on line 7 on page 1 of the A3, we would save up to $1,000 for a first violation and up to $2,000, was it, for a second and subsequent violation?
Yes.
And subsequent violations? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Members understand that?
May I ask a question?
Certainly, Senator Sharon.
As a lawyer would read this, is this per violation or
intention?
Mr. Fuller? He's still writing kind of fast, but we'll find out.
Mr. Chairman, the way I read this is that it's, well, the way it reads is that it's up to $1,000 for a first violation and up to $2,000 for a second and subsequent violation. Mm-hmm. So that it's not crystal clear, but I think it's each violation. That's what is intended, and, I guess. If we can make it crystal clear.
Mr. Chair, that is my intention. A swift, speedy remedy, and if you're not in compliance, a swift, speedy fine that increases with each violation.
Okay. I think it does.
Mr. Fuller.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
We're going to go to judiciary next. What I'm thinking about is if it's a, if this
actually, Senator Sharon, I'm told that if we make this change here, the bill will go straight to the floor.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Maybe Senator Bonoff's helping you out here.
Yes. Where it can continue to be amended. Because I want to take a look at this to see about, you know, if the person is fined $1,000 and still doesn't comply, is that within a certain period of time, is it a $2,000 fine, and if they don't comply, or if this is simply has to go to another incident?
It's my understanding that if we did adopt this, and Mr. Fuller can correct me, that if the human rights section comes out, your bill would not have to go to judiciary, and it could move right to the Senate floor with this change in it, if it's adopted.
I understand.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's right. The basis for judicial jurisdiction was a human rights reference, and that's gone.
Okay.
So it's very typical to send employment violation bills straight to the floor from this committee.
Call the question.
Senator Bonoff moves the A3 amendment.
As amended.
As amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now we have Senate File 2000 is amended in front of us. Senator Bonoff moves Senate File 2000 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, committee members. With that, our work for today is done. The meeting's adjourned.